to our listeners and welcome. I'm Sean Sanders from Science, and I'm very pleased to welcome you to this podcast discussion with the 2020 winners of the prestigious Eppendorfen Science Prize for Neurobiology. Each year, Science and Eppendorf come together to recognize exceptional young scientists who have made significant contributions to the field of neurobiology. And each year, when I meet the awardees, I am always impressed by their passion, their dedication, and their depth of knowledge of the various fields in which they do their research. I'm certain that this year will be no different, and I'm excited to share our conversation with you. I'd like to thank our sponsor, Eppendorf, a leading life sciences company based in Hamburg, Germany, that develops and sells instruments, consumables, and services for liquid handling, sample handling, and cell handling in laboratories worldwide. This year, Eppendorf celebrates 75 years of supporting the life science research community. Okay, so let's meet our winner and two finalists. The first runner-up is Dr. Tara LeGates from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Tara is an assistant professor in the UMBC Department of Biological Sciences, where her lab studies how neuronal circuits integrate information to regulate behavior and their alterations in psychiatric disorders. Welcome, Tara.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for having me.
Our other runner-up is Dr. Ricardo Beltramo, who is currently at the University of California, San Francisco. Ricardo is a postdoctoral research associate studying sensory perception in the mouse visual system, focusing on understanding how cortical and subcortical neural circuits process visual information to drive behavior. Thanks so much for joining us today, Ricardo.
Thanks so much, Sean. It's an honor to be here.
And finally, the grand prize winner is Dr. Christopher Zimmerman from the Princeton Neuroscience Institute at Princeton University in New Jersey. Christopher is a postdoctoral fellow and studies the neural mechanisms that govern thirst and drinking behavior. Hello and welcome, Christopher.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Thank you all once again for making the time to talk with me. Christopher, I'm going to start with you. Can you explain your prize-winning research in a way that doesn't require me to have a PhD in neuroscience like you do?
Hopefully. We want to answer a very simple question, which is, where does our sense of thirst come from? This feeling that we experience every day. We have a strong model from decades of research that this comes exclusively from our brain, from specialized cells that sit at the base of our brain and lie outside the blood-brain barrier, and can then sense when we're dehydrated by directly monitoring signals in our blood. This model's intuitive and explains how we can match our behavior to our needs, but it has one crucial shortcoming, which is that most of our drinking behavior, which is what thirst controls, is regulated on a really fast basis that evolves much more quickly than these signals in the blood can explain. So when we drink water, our thirst is satiated very quickly, many minutes before water is absorbed into the bloodstream. And we want to know how the brain solves this problem. To answer this, we chose to identify markers so that we could label and record from these dehydration sensing neurons deep in the brain, and then use new tools to record their activity as mice walked around their environment and drank water and ate food to ask what signals are regulating these cells. And consistent with this classical model, we saw that indeed they're regulated by dehydration signals. They're activated when an animal becomes dehydrated. But surprisingly, we found that they also receive an entirely separate class of signals that comes from elsewhere in the body, from the mouth and throat and gut, that doesn't say what the current hydration status of the animal is, but predicts how food and water that we eat and drink will affect the blood in the future and allows these cells to change our behavior preemptively. And this new class of signals is exciting because it allows us to explain this class of human behaviors that previously we had no idea how the brain controlled.
Fantastic. So the work that you've done thus far is in mouse models. So the obvious question is, how do these findings apply to humans?
That's a really good question. So we think that these findings should apply to humans because we know that these same brain structures also govern thirst in humans. For example, the area that I'm studying is activated when humans are thirsty, and when human patients have suspected damage to this brain region, they don't feel thirst normally. And on the other hand, the behaviors that we're studying, like the satiation of thirst that happens quickly when we drink, and the thirst that develops when we eat food, operate basically the same in mice as well as humans. So based on these two facts, we think these findings should apply Obviously, it's very hard to record from neurons deep in the brain of humans.
So reading your prize-winning essay, I was fascinated to find that the temperature of a liquid can have an effect on quenching thirst. And this seems like something we know intuitively, but I understand that you actually now better understand the scientific basis.
Yeah, so this is another interesting thing that came out of looking at how humans, including our from interospection, experience thirst. So humans often experience cold water as more thirst-quenching. And in hospitals, when patients are going into or out of surgery and can't drink, they're often given ice chips to help them relieve their thirst without taking in any fluids. And so we wondered if these neurons that we're setting in the brain might play a role in this process. Interestingly, what we found is that every time an animal drinks a lick of water, these thirst neurons in the brain are inhibited. But the amount they're inhibited actually changes depending on how or on what the temperature of the water is. So when the animal drinks cold water, every lick or every drink inhibits these neurons a little bit more than if that water were at room temperature, so that it actually takes less water for them to feel full and to no longer be motivated to drink.
And Chris, how do you see your work being applied in the future? What can this teach us?
I think this has pointed to two really interesting changes in how we think about these systems in our brain that control simple behaviors like eating and drinking. One is that there's a much greater focus now on signals that are coming from the rest of the body, from our mouth and throat and different internal organs that influence these really basic behaviors. And people are now starting to study these at the level of the brain. The other really exciting thing is that these new signals we found that are coming from these different body parts mean that there must be molecules and cells in those organs that are sensing things. Molecules in the mouth that sense water, molecules in the stomach that sense osmolarity, and we don't know the identity of these. So it's really a new area of molecular biology to go sort of find these molecules and understand how they're playing this role in thirst and maybe in other behaviors as well.
Now, getting away from the research part of this for a minute, what was your response when you found out that you were selected as the grand prize winner for this prize?
So it was very exciting to learn that I was selected as the winner of this prize. As scientists, we spend so much time thinking about our own research that it's wonderful to know that other scientists are just as excited about this specific area that we study. And at the same time, it's really exciting to know that this approach to research that really puts behavior and human behavior and these little pieces of our own experience at the forefront that can be as captivating as anything else.
What do you enjoy most about doing research? Where do you find your passion?
For me, the most exciting thing is really just the days when you get to record from neurons in a living animal that's going about its business and understand in a few minutes exactly how some process that you've been thinking about works. So new techniques for recording neurons are so powerful that now we can take, for example, the neurons that control thirst and just watch exactly how they behave as the animal drinks water and eats food, in a way that answers questions that have really intrigued physiologists and neuroscientists for decades, but we've never had the tools to answer them before. And that's those sort of moments where you can just know in an instant what the answer is are very exciting.
So now that you've won the Eppendorfin Science Prize, what's next? What are you planning to do in the next 5 to 10 years?
Hopefully I'll have my own lab in the next 5 to 10 years. So I'm really interested in how these sensory signals, especially the ones that come from within us, influence circuits in the brain that shape our behavior. My work on thirst and a lot of research in this area is focused on a simple behavior like drinking and a small set of brain cells that control it. And what I'd really like to do is understand how these and other sensory signals are influencing behavior at a much larger scale. So looking at cells that are distributed across the brain and how they're influencing many different behaviors at once and how those systems are interacting. And hopefully the sort of larger scale look at how sensory signals are influencing these simple behaviors will lead to some, you know, really basic principles that we can use to understand how these systems work.
You're still at the beginning of your career and, ramping up. So do you have any advice for other young scientists or maybe just finishing their graduate degrees and are thinking of doing a postdoc and want to follow the same track as you?
Yeah. So I think, there's some standard advice that really holds true, like to work hard and, not be discouraged when things don't work because it takes a long time for any project in science to come together. But I think for me, what's been the most important is to really just surround yourself with other scientists who will look out for your career and mentor you. And so for that can be an advisor who, you know, is really invested in you and cares, but also the other members in your lab who are doing hopefully exciting science and bring a lot to help you learn how to be a better scientist. And those two things have been immensely important in shaping me as a scientist.
Now, your work is all about thirst, and I heard that you enjoy brewing your own beer, so I'm intrigued. Is there any connection there?
You know, we need to drink water, and there's no reason that that can't taste good as well. You know, for me, I think brewing is just the right mix of experimentation and science and fun to be a good hobby. So I like, you know, the microbiology that goes into it with different yeasts and bacteria and hops that can come together to create something really delicious. But really, it's also the end product that makes it a fun hobby.
Well, I think you might have answered my next question, which is how do you balance your work and personal life? And I'm guessing beer might play into that.
It's a small part. Yeah, I have a lot of hobbies outside of lab that keep me sane. I try to spend a lot of time outdoors and getting away from just being in the lab all the time, because I think there are bouts of working that are really satisfying and really productive, but that recharging is really helpful to everyone's mental health and also leads to a lot of fun time just spent thinking and new ideas for things to try back in the lab. And so sort of spending a good amount of time doing outdoorsy things or other fun activities has helped me to sort of stay sane as a scientist, especially in current circumstances.
Yes, and talking about current circumstances, we are still in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. So I was interested to know if this has impacted your ability to do your research in any way.
Yeah, I think, you know, everyone's faced obstacles, and universities shutting down for 3 or 4 months was really hard, especially starting in a new position to get research up and running, although it was obviously a necessary precaution. I think really the biggest and maybe most unexpected at the outset challenge for me has been just losing all those informal conversations in the hallways with other scientists in the building or at conferences that really lead to a lot of fun ideas for experiments to do or projects to take on that are really hard to reproduce on Zoom or other telecommunications. Yeah, so it's been a challenge to deal without that personal interaction, because I think it actually brings a lot to our work.
But we're all getting to spend more time with our pets and our family, right?
That's true.
Well, thank you so much, Chris. Okay, Tara, you're up next. Could you share the work that you described in your winning essay?
Sure. So we're all very familiar with rewards, right? There are these attractive things or experiences that we're motivated to obtain. Evolutionarily, rewarding stimuli are really important for survival and fitness, like food. Foraging and finding food are critical for survival. And there are a number of factors involved in the process of reward and behaviors related to reward, like motivation, the drive to obtain those rewards, or contextual information, the surrounding context or location in which that reward was encountered. And those factors have to be properly integrated in order to achieve that reward. And we were really interested in the neuronal circuits that regulate that process. And so at the center of all this is the nucleus accumbens. It's a key brain structure that integrates input from various brain regions to integrate these factors that I was mentioning before to guide and regulate reward-related behaviors, like finding that food reward. And we were particularly interested in hippocampal input to the accumbens because it serves two important roles. The hippocampus is important in regulating contextual or spatial learning and memory, so finding that food reward, for instance. But the hippocampus also provides excitatory input to regulate the activity of the neurons in the nucleus accumbens, and that is really important for regulating reward behaviors. And when we start to see dysregulation in the nucleus accumbens, we start to see dysregulation in reward behaviors like are observed in addiction or depression, where anhedonia or loss of the pleasure derived from rewarding experiences are absent. And so this led us to the hypothesis that changes in the hippocampus to nucleus accumbens synapses are important in regulating reward behaviors. And we used a combination of whole cell electrophysiology in mouse brain slices, optogenetics, and behavior, and observed that plasticity of these synapses, or the change in the strength of the communication between the hippocampus and the nucleus accumbens, are really important or serve as critical regulators of reward behaviors. And so potentiation or increasing the strength of the communication between the hippocampus and the nucleus accumbens are rewarding, whereas weakening of the synapses and the inability to strengthen them are associated with anhedonia. And so this is really important for understanding how the brain regulates reward behaviors and how changes in this kind of communication between these brain regions, and specifically where these changes are occurring, might underlie psychiatric diseases like depression.
Tara, as with Chris's work, you also use mouse models. So I'll ask you this question as well. Do you believe that your findings can be translated into humans?
I do. And I think that that's really the great and powerful thing about studying a behavior like reward. It's this really important evolutionarily conserved behavior that you can observe and measure in mice and humans. And we know from a lot of research in both mice and humans that the brain region and the circuitry underlying the regulation of this behavior are also conserved. And so, for instance, functional imaging studies which allow researchers to measure activity in the brain have shown alterations in activity in regions like the hippocampus and the nucleus accumbens in depressed patients, and also changes in the connectivity between those regions, very similar to what we've observed in our mouse models.
So how do you think this work might be applied in the future, and what can it teach us?
Our work provides a novel target for understanding the neurobiological mechanisms that underlie reward. And not just in the sense that this region connects to this other region, but really in understanding how changes in the communication between two brain regions can result in changes in reward behaviors. If we can understand how specific brain regions are changing, for instance, in response to chronic stress, we can refine our approach to tackling devastating psychiatric diseases like depression. And this would mean more effective and faster acting treatments without unnecessary side effects, as are seen in traditional antidepressants that are used in the clinic now.
Now, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the Eppendorf and Science Prize itself. Were you surprised that your work was recognized through this prize?
Honestly, I was. I mean, when you're working on a project and talking or writing about it, you think it's really exciting, right? But given the nature of publishing papers and getting grants, it's always a nice surprise when somebody else agrees with you.
Now, what do you love about doing your research, and what gets you up and into the lab every day?
So I really like exploring new things. I essentially get paid to be curious and be creative, to ask questions and then come up with the best way to answer them. And it's so exciting when you find something new, right? It's not in a textbook or in a paper. It's something brand new that only you know. And that's pretty awesome and exciting. But I think what's even better that I get to do even more now as an assistant professor is seeing that excitement of discovery in my own students and trainees.
Where do you see yourself in 5 or 10 years? You know, where are you going to take this excitement, and what would you like to accomplish?
So I'm just starting my lab. So my knee-jerk answer is publish papers, get grants, and get tenure. And from a scientific standpoint, I want to understand how brain regions communicate with one another to integrate information and regulate physiology and behavior, and how changes in that communication can lead to psychiatric diseases or disorders. But at the basis of those very broad and expansive research goals, I want to have a thriving lab. And when I say thriving, I mean not just that we're being productive and doing good science, but that it's a cohesive lab environment where members are thriving and they feel fulfilled, where people are excited to come in and work together and make new discoveries together. My goal is to make significant contributions to the scientific community, and doing that by doing good science, but also fostering the development of trainees as they become independent scientists.
Well, this leads nicely to my next question, which is, what advice do you have for young researchers who are coming up through the ranks and maybe want to follow the same track that you're on?
So my advice, first of all, would be to keep at it. It's hard, and there are a lot of failures or hurdles, you know, experiments that don't work, mice that won't behave, that noise that you can't cancel on your rig, papers rejected, grants not funded. And these are all regular things that are happening to everyone, whether they like to talk about them or not. And it doesn't make it easier, but it's not a reflection on you. So don't compare yourself to other people to constantly find ways that you're coming up short. We usually are our biggest critic, but we also need to be our biggest cheerleader. So be kind to yourself and be kind to others. Pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and keep at it. And celebrate the victories, even when they're small ones. And lastly, don't be afraid to think outside the box, to speak up, to ask questions, ask for help. Learn new things and learn new techniques. Those aren't always things that we want to do, they tend to generate discomfort, right? You don't want to look stupid or ignorant. But if you can get comfortable with being uncomfortable, that's really where the growth happens and where you really learn new things.
Now, Tara, you shared a really interesting story with me about how you ended up in this career, which I understand began when you were an accounting major. So I find this incredible. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Yeah. So when I was applying to and starting college, I didn't really have a strong sense of a goal of what I wanted to do, but accounting seemed like a responsible choice. So my thought process was, okay, you go to college to learn to do something to get a job. And so accounting was responsible. And so that's what I did. But my first semester at Rider University, which was where I went to undergrad, I was taking my required science class of all non-science majors. And that was a neuroscience class designed for these non-majors. And I found that I really loved it, which was new for me because I never had a strong interest in science classes when I was, you know, before college. And I found this class way more interesting than the idea of accounting. And so after talking with the professor and some other people, I decided to just take a leap and change my major to behavioral neuroscience, or at the time, the major was called biopsychology. And that's where I really fell in love with research, and it really sort of changed my life and was integral. That experience and the mentorship that I received at Rider was integral in essentially turning me into a scientist.
Wow, that's fantastic. Now, you're also a mom and you work full time. How have you managed to balance your work and personal life, especially with quarantining during the coronavirus pandemic?
So it's something that I'm still trying to figure out how to do, to be honest, but I try to be organized and efficient and have a running schedule. So that way there's, you know, work time and there's family time, which is also something that helps me feel a little less overwhelmed when I have a lot going on, which is pretty much all the time right now. But I think more importantly, it's not something that I do alone. So I'm really lucky and grateful to have a great co-parenting and support system. And my husband, who's just all around amazing, has been and continues to be the keystone that keeps it all together and helps me balance that without going crazy.
So what other challenges has the pandemic created related to your ability to do your research? Are you able to get into the lab at all?
Yeah, so for a while, the labs were pretty much shut down for, you know, maintenance mode only. But we're back open again and operating at a limited capacity. But I've only had my lab for a year now, and I have two, you know, pretty recent new graduate students who are still learning things. So when we were first allowed to go back into the lab, I went in and immediately filmed a bunch of short videos of myself doing various things around the lab and sent them the videos for how to do them. Because in some of the places, you know, it's kind of tight quarters where we can't effectively social distance, so they can watch the videos and then know how to do the things when they get there.
That's a fantastic idea. I wonder if anybody else has thought of doing that.
I need a GoPro so I can attach it to my head.
That's an excellent idea, Tara. Okay, we're going to move on to our final guest, and that is Ricardo. Ricardo, could you describe the fascinating work that you've done on the visual centers in the brain?
Yeah, so I've been always fascinated by sensory perception, and in particular by visual perception. I find very intriguing the idea that in our brain, there are circuits that somehow take information from the external environment and then transform the inputs from the pixels of the cameras that we have in our retinas and transform that in a meaningful image that we can perceive. So my work focuses on the visual system and specifically on the cerebral cortex, which is, evolutionarily speaking, the most recent part of our brain. And the cortical circuits of the visual system are among the most carefully characterized parts of our brain. So according to the standard models, visual information reaches the cerebral cortex in the so-called primary visual cortex, which is also called V1. And V1 is called primary because it gets inputs from the periphery. Then V1 projects to higher visual cortices, and those are called higher because their responses are believed to depend on the activity of V1. Now, in contrast to this hierarchical model, I discovered that one of these so-called higher visual areas does not rely at all on V1, on the primary visual cortex. And this area is called the postrinal cortex, or POR. Now, I found that after silencing the activity of V1, the visual responses of the postrinal cortex, and let's call it POR from now on, were still intact. So if not from V1, then how does POR get visual input? And following a very careful set of experiments, we discovered that POR receives visual information from an evolutionarily ancient midbrain structure called superior colliculus. So the superior colliculus, it's the main visual center of many vertebrates like fish and reptiles and so on. So this discovery, in a sense, crumbles a long-standing dogma and showing the existence of a novel primary visual cortex independent of V1. So in other words, my work defines a new cortical entry point of visual information.
Ricardo, I really enjoyed the historical context that you added to your prize-winning essay when you talked about some of the pioneering work in your field being done in your home country of Italy. Is that a connection that drew you to this work?
Well, the answer is yes and no. And so the answer is yes, because it is true that the Italian heritage inspired my interest in neuroscience. So Italy gave birth to many outstanding scientists that defined the field of neuroscience itself. One of them, for example, is Camillo Golgi, who developed a technique to stain neurons named the black reaction, or in Italian, la reazione nera, and that really changed neuroscience. However, the pioneering work I talked about in my essay didn't inspire my studies because, unfortunately, I didn't know anything about it before starting my project. And so, in my essay, I write about Bartolomeo Panizza, who was in the 19th century a professor of anatomy at the University of Pavia, just a couple of hours driving from the town where I grew up in Italy. And Panizza observed patients who became blind after a stroke in the posterior part of their brain and made a very bold claim, namely, visual function is localized in the cerebral cortex. So he performed targeted cortical lesions in several experimental animals and confirmed his hypothesis of a cortical regions dedicated to visual processing, which then became known as V1, as the primary visual cortex. And this was truly a revolutionary discovery. So I didn't know anything about this. And the reason is that Panizza's work was largely ignored by his contemporaries. So many years passed before his research was accorded the credit it deserved. And even today, not many people in the field even know about him.
Ricardo, you moved to the US from Italy to do research here. I was interested to know why you moved and how does research differ between these two countries?
Right. Well, since our conversation took an historical turn, let's give it that way, right? This brings me back to the very Italian definition of the Renaissance scientist, a la Leonardo da Vinci, who should push the boundaries and search over the horizon. So a good scientist should be well-traveled. And for me, it was very important to leave the nest in Italy and explore new environments. There was something romantic, if you want, in the idea of crossing the ocean, and the United States were a perfect destination.
So how do you think your research can help move this field forward?
Well, the discovery of a new primary visual cortex basically opens a Pandora's box of potential new projects. Of course, the results of my research are especially relevant to the scientists that study the mechanism of visual processing and sensory perception. But our results also increase our understanding of a quite interesting clinical condition, which is known as blindsight. So people who suffer from blindsight are considered clinically blind because of damage to the primary visual cortex. But you know, the reality is more complex than that. In fact, people with blindsight, even if they are clinically blind, are still able to identify the position of incoming threatening objects and to navigate obstacles unconsciously without even realizing it. So this intriguing phenomenon does not depend on V1, right? Because the primary visual cortex is damaged. But it's believed to depend on the collicular pathway. So our discovery of POR, which is part of the collicular pathway, and POR is a cortical area independent of V1, could benefit the medical community that studies blind sight in human subjects.
Ricardo, I hear that you're a big fan of kite surfing and regular surfing. So is that what you like to do when you're not in the lab?
Well, yeah, I definitely consider learning how to surf one of the biggest achievements of my postdoc in San Diego. And, you know, then one day, it was after less than a year since I joined the lab, Massimo said, well, I was thinking of moving the lab to San Francisco. And well, so we moved there. And in the Bay Area, I discovered what became my new favorite hobby, which is kitesurfing. That is basically surfing in the water pulled by a kite, very similar to a paraglider. So it's a lot of fun, a lot of adrenaline, and very addictive. So my productivity in the lab started to suspiciously correlate with the wind and weather forecast. And this kind of pushed Massimo, my current mentor, to tell me that, you know, surfing and kitesurfing are good and fun, but don't forget that they are weekend activities. So I guess that's what it means these days, balancing work and personal life.
So the final question that I have for you, Ricardo, is we're still in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. So I was interested to know how this has impacted your research, if at all.
Yeah, well, surfing and kitesurfing ended up being extraordinarily compatible with the lab lockdown and social distancing. So I really can't complain. And about my research, I'm now in a stage where I need a lot of time to read, to understand better the existing literature, so I can develop an original research program for my own future lab. So the lockdown allowed me to do so. And I've been very lucky because the pandemic has not really impacted my research activity too much. Well, yeah, and of course, yeah, I hope you're going to find a vaccine as soon as possible so this can be over.
Thank you, Ricardo, and also Chris and Tara. It's been so much fun talking to all of you, and very best of luck with your research. I hope you manage to get back to your labs very soon.
Thanks for having me, Sean. This has been fun.
Thanks again for having me, Sean. It was great to chat with you.
Thanks so much, Sean. It was awesome talking to you too.
And thank you to our audience for listening in. If you'd like to send me any questions or comments about this podcast, you can email me at custompodcast@aaas.org. And if you'd like more information about the Eppendorfen Science Prize for Neurobiology, you can browse over to eppendorf.com/prize. Thanks again to Eppendorf for their support and to our podcast listeners for joining us. And congratulations once again to Chris, Tara, and Ricardo. I'm Sean Sanders. Thank you for listening.